Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Ambassador Wendy Sherman on negotiating with North Korea and leading the U.S. team through the talks that yielded the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. Sherman's new book is a memoir of her years in the State Department and an explanation of the values that guided her to the highest levels of international diplomacy, including her capacity for empathy and her willingness to be real with her foreign counterparts. Our conversation starts after a short break. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Whether or not you agreed with the details of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal, you have to admire the kind of three-dimensional chess required to get it done. Think about it. You had stakeholders as diverse as China, Germany, Russia, the UK, and France, plus, of course, the United States and Iran. And then there were months of dogged preparation ahead of weeks of intensive talks. It's easy to assume the diplomats who pulled it together are just somehow supernaturally gifted. But Ambassador Wendy Sherman, lead negotiator for the U.S. on the deal, is eager for us to understand it's her ability to be human that has allowed her to have such an outsized impact on international relations throughout her career. These days, Sherman is senior counselor at Albright Stonebridge Group and senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. Previously, she served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Obama administration and special advisor and policy coordinator on North Korea in the Clinton administration. Her book is called Not for the Faint of Heart: Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. Ambassador Sherman, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Chris, and great to be with your listeners.
I think we're not always aware of the preparation that goes into an effort like the Iran deal before anybody sits down across the table from the other parties. Can you walk us through what had to happen before you and your team went to Vienna in the summer of 2015?
It's really, as you pointed out in your introduction, an extraordinary undertaking. I joke, only halfway a joke, that I consulted inside of the administration, which meant meetings at the State Department, but also lots of meetings in the situation at the White House, meetings with the president, to agree on how we were going to proceed. I negotiated with Congress because we needed to know what the members of Congress were thinking and what they thought should go forward. I negotiated with each member of the permanent members of the Security Council. That's the United States, Russia, China, Great Britain, France, plus Germany and the European Union, because they were our negotiating partners in this. I negotiated with Israel, which had a huge security stake in what happened. I negotiated with the Gulf states, who also cared, with any country that was impacted by what we were about to do. Negotiated with nonprofits and NGOs that care about these nonproliferation issues. And yeah, of course, occasionally, I negotiated with Iran, so it's a very complicated process, and at each step along the way, you have to go back and repeat all of those consultations so that you keep people up to date, you know what they're thinking, and of course, there's an enormous amount of technical work that goes in it. Not to belabor this point too long, but although people know President Obama led this effort along with Secretary Kerry, Secretary of State, and Secretary Moniz, the Secretary of Energy, and perhaps me, I had a core team of 15 people, but literally hundreds of people in the U.S. government, hundreds, were involved in this effort, including, of course, our military, who arrayed our forces in a way to say we were serious, the president commissioned and deployed a new weapon that could penetrate underground facilities if, God forbid, we had to take military action, but we needed to be ready. We used our intelligence community, obviously. We even set up a virtual embassy Tehran over the internet so we could try to speak directly to the Iranian people. So it is a very complex and very labor-intensive process.
So you need to be aware the entire time not only of the potential benefits to the United States and what we're prepared to give in return, but what those, how that calculus works for every other potential signatory.
Absolutely. And You have to find the common ground, the good part of this, if there's a good part of such a complicated negotiation, is that the P5 plus one, the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany and the European Union, shared a singular objective, and that was to ensure that Iran never obtain a nuclear weapon. And that commitment to that cause got us through a lot of difficult spots because during these negotiations, Russia invaded Ukraine, tried to annex illegally Crimea, and set up what we affectionately call the Little Green Men in eastern Ukraine to try to thwart the democratically elected government. So it's a very complicated situation.
In the aftermath of the Russian invasion, specifically of Ukraine, you were reminded of the importance of compartmentalization.
Yes. One of my colleagues, Sergei Ryabkov, the head of the Russian delegation on the daily basis, of course, Foreign Minister Lavrov was very involved as well. But we were all organized in a room getting ready to have a coordination meeting before sitting down with the Iranians. And people were milling around, getting their morning coffee. Some people, you know, getting that last piece of pastry before the hard-fought day began. And Russia had just taken this action, and I was furious. I was just furious. And I saw Sergei, and sometimes you can have a really private conversation in a crowded room. And I said, "Sergei, what are you doing?" And it took him a moment to realize what I was talking about. And he said, "Nothing is amiss," and walked away from me. And he had never walked away from me before. But I realized that what he knew, and I should have known immediately, was we would have a terrible fight, and it might have an impact on the negotiations for which we were obligated to be in the room and to try to find a solution. And so the best thing he could do was walk away. We did and continue to push back hard against the Russians for what they did in Ukraine and sanction them during the Iran negotiations. So you don't stop doing what you have to do. You just can't always do it in the exact moment at the same time.
So you were working with diplomats from very different cultures with very different domestic constituencies and expectations. That obviously makes things challenging. On the other hand, you spent vast amounts of time with these people, so you knew them as people. And you stress that, like, human relationship, that component of diplomacy can't be overstated.
Indeed. You've got to find common ground with the people with whom you're going to spend so much time. In the last round in Vienna of the negotiation, I was in a hotel for 25 days. I had exactly one meal outside of the hotel. And we all ate together, that is, the P5 plus one in the European Union. Iran had a separate eating room because our eating room had alcohol, and that was not permissible for them.
Right.
So we tried to find common ground, and Abbas Araghchi, who was the lead on the Iranian side with his partner Majid Ravanchi, he and I both became grandparents for the first time during this negotiation. So we would show each other photos on our iPhones. And it's not that we stopped fighting for our national interests. We were quite fierce in that regard. But we saw each other as human beings that were trying to solve a problem that might create greater peace for the world. That doesn't mean he didn't have other ambitions out of these talks and that I didn't have other ambitions out of these talks, but it did create a little humanity in the room, which helped us get through some difficult moments.
You say the most critical training you ever had was as a social worker.
Yes, I've had a wonderfully unexpected life, which I wish for all of your listeners. My professional training, I have a master's in social work in principally community organizing, but also clinical skills, which I say have been very helpful with dictators and members of Congress and many other people. But those organizing skills created a core set of skills in how to work with groups, how to create a common objective, how to reach that objective, how to organize for that objective. And I've used that skill set in everything I've done, and I've done many different things in my life. And what I say to young people, and I try to talk with them whenever I can, because they're our future, is get yourself a set of core skills, whether that's in law, as a teacher, a social worker, a nurse, an engineer, an electrician, a plumber. And then if things come along in life that you see as new opportunities, you probably can use some of the skills you've learned, including the interpersonal skills, of course, in whatever you do in life, including your relationships with people.
You spend a fair amount of time in this book, Ambassador Sherman, explaining how Iranians feel about the U.S., which I think is a perspective that often gets overlooked when we're frustrated by Iran's contrarian positions. Of course, we know, we believe that we have the best intentions. Can you talk about what the U.S. government represents to the Iranians?
Well, Americans who think about Iran, who are old enough, tend to remember 1979 and the Iranian Revolution, where Iran held many Americans hostage for 444 days. And we imposed very heavy sanctions on Iran for that action and created great animus, understandably so, here in this country. But what most Americans don't know is in the 1950s, Iran had an elected government, including Prime Minister Mossadegh, and he thought about whether he should nationalize the oil fields in Iran to improve their economy and their control over their economy. Well, quite frankly, the British didn't like that very much, and the United States wasn't very excited about it. And so the American intelligence agency, the CIA, worked with British intelligence and staged a coup and overthrew Mossadegh and inserted the Shah, who was then displaced by the revolution. And the Iranians thought that the United States and Great Britain had acted as colonial powers that could decide the future of another country that had had the beginnings of a democracy and a fair and free election. And so it created some of the groundwork for the revolution, because the Shah, although he was America's guy, was truly dictatorial and quite horrific, and in many, many ways to the Iranian people. That spurred the revolution. Death to America became part of the mantra of that revolution unto this day, helps to create the nationalist spirit and the clerical mullah mantra together to keep Iran moving forward in the way that it is, which is really a very authoritarian government without a true democracy, even though they have elections, they aren't true democracy, and makes it a very complicated relationship for us. And beyond the revolution, what was done with Americans, their animus towards us because of what we did in the 1950s regarding their government and the imposition of the Shah, we, of course, are very, very concerned about what Iran is doing in the Middle East and the malign behavior in the Middle East. We're all keeping an eye on what's happening in Syria and great concern about Bashar al-Assad, the current leader of Syria's efforts with the help of Russia and Iran to take over Idlib, one of the last remaining holdouts in that awful, awful civil war.
What's it like to see a Death to Wendy Sherman poster out in the streets?
It's a little unnerving. It was very unnerving for my family. We got past it. That came about because I testified in front of the Senate, which I did quite a bit. And in answer to a question posed by a senator about whether Iran was deceptive, I said deceptions in their DNA that created a terrible outcry, including that death to Wendy Sherman. I did an interview with Voice of America and said I regretted those words soon after some of those posters disappeared, and we got on with the negotiation.
My guest is Ambassador Wendy Sherman. She served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Obama administration, and she will be at the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin at the end of the month. You can find details at tribfest.org. Ambassador Sherman's new book is called Not for the Faint of Heart: Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ambassador Wendy Sherman, who served as the lead negotiator for the United States on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. She's got a new book out called Not for the Faint of Heart: Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send a tweet to us at KERAThink. Ambassador Sherman, you were not a subject expert in Iran when you were named Undersecretary for Political Affairs in 2011. How did you go about learning what you needed to know?
One of the things one has to understand about each of ourselves is who we are, what we're good at, what we're not good at. I am very lucky. I was born with a fabulous short-term memory. I have a completely terrible long-term memory, but I can stuff a lot in my brain very quickly when needed, and that's come in handy very, very often. And in the case of Iran, I spent my first week at the UN General Assembly, which is coming up in September in New York shortly. So I didn't get into my office in Washington until a week after I was sworn in. And no sooner had gotten my office than I got a call from the FBI that they had arrested an Iranian who had landed in New York, who had been, it appeared, part of a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador at a very popular restaurant in Georgetown in Washington called Cafe Milano. This had all been undone through work that had been done in Mexico. This guy had come through Mexico to the United States, was landing in New York, and got picked up by the FBI and had been helped by another Iranian. And all of a sudden, even before I began the negotiations, I was plunged into dealing with this knowing that I would want to be able to call countries around the world and make sure they understood this was a very, very serious matter, and that we hoped that the UN General Assembly would condemn this act by Iran. And so I gathered everyone in the department, including our intelligence and research unit, to spend a considerable amount of time with me, just really giving me a crash course in Iran. That obviously isn't enough. I always had with me on the team someone who was an expert. We had a Farsi speaker, a wonderful man named Alan Eyre, whose whole job really throughout the negotiation was to read all the Farsi press, look at tweets in Farsi, and tell us what was being said, and to help make sure that we didn't schedule things on days that had meaning in Iranian culture, that I knew what the traditions and culture were, what was expected, all the different symbolic things might mean that we would do or that Iran would do. So you have to learn fast, but also have people around you who can keep you schooled on a constant basis.
How often in talks to create the Iran deal were you the highest ranking woman or the only woman in the room?
Well, there were certainly times I was the only woman in the room, particularly when we had bilateral talks with Iran. But this was an unusual negotiation because it was coordinated by the High Representative of the European Union. And in the first instance, that was Cathy Ashton. And when she stepped down, it was Federica Mogherini, so two women. And my European Union counterpart, who is the unsung hero of this negotiation because she spent so much time with the Iranians, was a German diplomat who's a European Union official named Helga Schmidt. So the Iranians, who were all men, of course, And virtually every other delegation was all men. There was a woman here or there, but not a senior, was led by women. And that was most unusual and really quite terrific.
The Iranian political system pretty deliberately restricts women's rights. Did that ever feel like an impediment to you when you were dealing with Iranian diplomats?
Well, I say a few things about that. First of all, that Madeleine Albright, who I had the pleasure of being her counselor when she was Secretary of State, we had been longtime friends and colleagues before that. We then, after the Clinton administration, built a business together, and so I consider her a business partner, but over and above everything else, a friend. And a role model. And she told me a long time ago that when you sit across the negotiating table as a government official, you're not Wendy Sherman or a woman or even in my case an American Jew. You are the United States of America. And that is an incredibly powerful position. And if you understand it and use it, you can get past quite a bit. I certainly found that to be true. There were certainly times where being a woman was a little awkward. The most obvious is that none of the men in the Iran delegation could shake hands with me. And we sort of have a workaround. We women, we put our hands across our chest, hold our hearts, and sort of nod our heads in greeting. But it's a little odd, particularly when you have all these men and you keep doing it. You look a little bit like the Marx Brothers. So one day, in wanting to find common ground with Abbas Araghchi and Majid Ravanchi, I said, you know, it is a little awkward not being able to shake your hand. But I grew up in a community as an American Jew where I was among Orthodox Jews a fair amount. And the men in that part of our religion do not shake women's hands either. It was a fascinating discussion. I think at first they were a little taken aback, and it was awkward for them, for me to be talking about this. But as we discussed it, it became a way of having the most unusual common ground, particularly given that many in Iran and officially deny the Holocaust and want Israel to disappear off the face of the earth. That said, it was a useful discussion.
So the JCPOA was literally your final goal for yourself at the State Department. You had announced that you would retire at the conclusion of those negotiations. So it's exhausting. It's sometimes infuriating. You're really close to the end. And then there's this 11th hour stunt pulled by the lead Iranian negotiator. You had a visceral emotional reaction and you didn't try to hide it.
Right. It's part of what I'm try to say, and you have said, Chris, quite eloquently, which is that we are our most powerful selves when we are our most authentic selves, when we know who we are and we make use of that in every way possible, not in a cynical or manipulative way, but just because this is truly who I am. So the story you're talking about is we were on the last bit of negotiating in the last, virtually the last day. And I was meeting with Abbas Araghchi and Majid Ravanchi with my deputy, Rob Malley, who really ran everything in the Middle East at the White House. And we were trying to resolve the UN resolution on, which wasn't part of the deal per se, but had to be rewritten to include the deal and rewrite all the previous UN resolutions. And the United States has always held the pen on the Iran resolution, so it was just a bilateral negotiation. And the EU is not part of the Security Council, so of course they were not in the room. I had put a piece of paper on the table with some formulas I thought would work. And indeed, Abbas said he thought one of them would. But then he said he had one more thing he wanted to bring up. And I was like livid. We were in an extension. I was supposed to go to Harvard as a fellow for the whole fall. I knew now that I was never going to get there on time because even if we got this deal, we had to go back to Congress and get it through the review process in Congress. That was a 60-day process. So my entire life was just screwed up. And I was furious. And somewhere along the line, I learned that women aren't supposed to get mad or get angry. And so I cry instead. And so here I was yelling at a boss that I'd had enough, that he was putting the entire deal at risk, as well as my own plans, but the deal being the most important, and tears started flowing down my eyes. I could do nothing about it. I told them that, you know, when I get angry, I cry. They shouldn't pay attention to the tears. It was really all about anger. They thought they'd figured out their way around me, but they were stunned into silence. Even Rob, bless his heart, wasn't quite sure what he was supposed to do with this somewhat raving, raving isn't quite the right word, but angry negotiator. But a boss reflected and withdrew his objection. And the resolution was agreed, and the deal was, in essence, done.
And you're clear that you would never, ever use tears as a tactic, but you also recognize that you were, as you said, simply being authentic. You were just not concealing your emotion.
Right, indeed. And no, I would not urge anyone to use tears as a tactic or to learn how to cry as a tactic. It's something I really, really regret about me. And it's funny, at the end of all of this, I went off to Harvard, but President Obama had wonderfully asked me to come back for lunch. And so I went up to Boston over the weekend, but came back on Monday to Washington to have lunch with him, just the two of us. And Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, Susie George, the Chief of Staff of the National Security Council, both good friends, came into the waiting room and said, we've come to see you before you meet with the president because we want you to know he's going to give you the National Security Medal. And when you're emotional, sometimes you cry, and we don't want you to cry. So we wanted to let you know in advance. I was incredibly, incredibly moved. Susan was there when the president made the presentation and the military attaché read off the commendation, and I didn't cry.
My guest is Ambassador Wendy Sherman, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs during the Obama administration. Her new book is called Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. And first up, we have Sharah in Austin. Hi.
Hi, it's actually Sarah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine. Yes, so my question is for Wendy Sherman. How, as an expert negotiator, do you get people to listen to you? And have you ever dealt with someone who wouldn't listen and was being particularly difficult and such? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Inside of whatever team I create, wherever I am to do work, I want to hear everybody's point of view. But if I'm the leader, at the end of the day, it's not a democracy. I'm going to be the decision maker. But I also want to make sure that on every team I put together, there's a skeptic. Because it's important to always question your first principles and to listen to people who might disagree. So you create norms for the group that we all move together, that everybody is valued and valuable. I always have everybody sit at the same table together unless there's super classified information only some people can know. Otherwise, everybody hears everything. So we move as a team together. But I also want to hear voices. Towards the end of this negotiation, a young member of the team, very smart, very capable, had some concerns. And I sat down with him. It turned out he had 52 concerns. And I had to take a really deep breath, but I listened to them all. Many of them were technical, so I sent him to Secretary Moniz to make sure they got included. And by the end of the negotiation, virtually all of them were included. So I think as a team leader, you create norms, you create some rules as well. Make sure I know if something goes wrong. I don't want to be the last person to know. Take risks. I'd rather pull you back than push you out. But the norm is we're all in this together. We're all heading towards the same thing. We need to listen to each other. At the end of the day, we need to move as a team. In a larger group, as in the Iran negotiation, of course there were times we disagreed violently with the Iranians and even with some of our negotiating partners. And you have to listen hard See if there is common ground, if you can find a place to come together. And sometimes, many times, Secretary Kerry would say to the president, or I would say to Secretary Kerry or to the president, I'm not sure we can do this. And there were a couple of times where Secretary Kerry said to Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran and the real leader of their effort, you know, if you can't do this, Javad, go home and get some instructions or tell me it's not just doable. You also have to be ready to walk away if necessary. And there were more than one time when we thought this would not succeed.
You didn't grow up in a family of diplomats. Your dad was a real estate guy in Baltimore, but he set this pretty extraordinary example for you of what it means to do the right thing, knowing that there will be a cost.
Absolutely. You know, many of us watched the funeral events of Senator John McCain, and I disagreed with him tremendously on many issues, but I had no doubt he was not only an enormous patriot, but a man of enormous courage. I don't think I could have done what he did in the Hanoi Hilton during the Vietnam War. And my father, who fought in World War II at Guadalcanal, I thought he and my mother were tremendous courage. At a Rosh Hashanah sermon, with Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, about to come up this Sunday evening and Monday, he went to a sermon in early 60s, and the rabbi talked about how he had been a chaplain in the concentration camps after liberating the concentration camps. And he wondered at the time what the priests and the ministers had said to their congregations about what was happening to the Jewish community. And he thought that in Baltimore, where he had just been arrested for trying to integrate a amusement park, why he felt he needed to tell his congregation why he did that. And he said that for him, this was his responsibility in the 60s to not allow discrimination to happen to African Americans. My father was incredibly moved by the sermon and spoke to the rabbi, who said, you should advertise open housing. And my father and mother agreed to do that, even though my father had said to the rabbi, this will cost me my business. And the rabbi said, well, you asked what to do, this is it. My parents did it. It did ultimately cost my father his business, but he never, and my mother, never regretted it. They were willing to pay the cost. It was a great lesson for me.
My guest is Ambassador Wendy Sherman. She was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs during the Obama administration and has a new book out called Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. You can be part of this conversation at 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ambassador Wendy Sherman, who served in the Department of State during the Obama and Clinton administrations and was lead negotiator for the United States on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal. Her book is called Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. Ambassador Sherman, you know that sometimes secrecy in diplomatic communications is a factor of the lack of trust in the other party. So early talks in advance of the JCPOA were kept quiet so that they wouldn't hurt progress of UN-based talks if things went south between the U.S. and Iran. Can you help us understand that?
Sure. President Obama made a very courageous decision, and that is to reach out to Iran. And he indeed, even in his inauguration speech, said that we would reach out if Iran would unclench its fist. And as it turned out, then Senator John Kerry, who was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, had gotten some feelers from the Sultan of Oman that Iran really was interested in seeing if there was some way to break through all of the sanctions that were on them and the difficult relationship between our countries. And he took that to then Secretary Hillary Clinton and President Obama. They agreed to test that out. This was during a time when Iran was run by the president, Ahmadinejad, who was quite a hard hardliner, as one might call it. And at any rate, to make a long story short, it looked like there might be some traction. And even during that difficult time, led by Bill Burns, a really diplomat's diplomat, extraordinary Foreign Service officer, who had become Deputy Secretary of State, and indeed I had replaced him. He had been the Undersecretary before me. He and I knew each other quite well, having worked together in Clinton. He, along with Jake Sullivan, who by then was National Security Advisor for Joe Biden, though he'd started out working for Secretary Clinton and ended up running Clinton's foreign policy during her presidential campaign, they led a tiny team that went to Oman to have these discussions. The discussions didn't really take off until President Rouhani, a reformer in Iranian terms, not in our terms, but in Iranian terms, became president. And then they really took off, and I joined those talks at the very end of them as we were drafting a short-term agreement to give us time to negotiate a full agreement. And that, what became known as the Joint Plan of Action, was then brought into the P5 plus one negotiations with brackets still remaining, things that still had to be resolved. But it never would have happened without those secret negotiations because Iran could do it quietly to deal with their politics. We could do it quietly to deal with our politics. If we could try out ideas without them being destroyed in the process. And it worked extremely well.
So you note in the book that in matters dealing with North Korea, the Russians often defer to the Chinese, and things are reversed in matters dealing with Iran. We have a question here from Mike in Houston that I think relates to that. Hi, Mike.
I have a question on Russian diplomacy. I know the ambassador touched on this a little bit at the beginning. My father-in-law is MIA from the Korean War and is one of two high-priority cases that is now being considered by the U.S.-Russia Joint Commission on POW-MIA matters. They are researching in their archives for further information on his fate. Anyway, it's my understanding that in recent years there are two areas in diplomacy between the United States and Russia that have been pretty stable. One would be the space program, NASA. They've cooperated, and we've done a lot of joint missions with them. And the other is the POW-MIA problem. It's easy to understand why they are cooperating and interested in working with us on NASA and space projects. But I'm trying to get some sense of their motivation on working with us in helping us solve mysteries of our missing soldiers, given that Russia traditionally and lately has they treat their soldiers and casualty families very poorly.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Mike. What can you tell us about that, Ambassador Sherman?
Well, first of all, Mike, I'm sorry that you've had to grow up a good deal of your life and have a good deal of your life without your father. That's really, really tough for anyone, and particularly in a situation of war where they're missing in action and you have no idea what has happened. It's just leaves so many question marks for so long. So I am very sorry for you for having to have endured that. I don't know entirely why the Russians engage with us on this. What I'll say more broadly is, as much as I also joined so many others in thinking what the Russians did during the 2016 campaign was horrific. It was more than meddling in our election. It was trying to divide our democracy and create havoc and chaos in our democracy and very, very dangerous cyber play on their part. And they should be sanctioned. What they are doing in other parts of the world are also terrible. They're quite aggressive in Europe and a great risk, obviously, what they did in Ukraine. Their actions in Syria. But there also have been places where we have been able to work together. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is one area. I also worked with Secretary Kerry, Sergei Lavrov, and Sergei Ryabkov on the chemical weapons deal with Syria. And although it didn't solve all problems, it got out tons of chemical weapons out of Syria that no one ever could imagine could have been taken out of Syria, and probably prevented even more chemical attacks than we have seen. And as you point out, the space program has been one. The only thing I can think of on the POW/MIA is a humanitarian issue that doesn't have a political meaning so much for them. They were involved in the margins of the process of coming to an armistice in Korea, and so have some stakes, and they have some stakes in the future of the Korean Peninsula as well.
It can't have come as a surprise to you that President Trump announced the U.S. would withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Will you talk, though, about how you felt when he made that official?
Well, you're quite right, Chris. It wasn't a surprise. Early in his administration, he stopped certifying the deal but did not withdraw, and I think he had advisors around him who really pushed him hard to stay in. Some of those advisors left. He was frustrated. He was under a lot of pressure from other countries to withdraw and from his own political constituencies, so he did. I was actually in Valletta, Malta, on the day that it happened, was not shocked, but was very sad by it. And I was sad not just for myself and for our team, but most of all, I was sad for our country, because I thought that our security was now more at risk. There was not a plan going forward to how to ensure that Iran would not obtain a nuclear weapon. I have yet to see a real plan about how to deal with Iran's malign behavior in the Middle East, which is serious and of great concern to all of us. And the reason that we only negotiated a deal that dealt with Iran's nuclear weapons was because we felt that was the greatest danger. If they had a nuclear weapon, they could project even more power into the Middle East and deter our actions. And if we'd included everything in the Iran deal, we would have ended up negotiating one off against the other. Iran would have said, well, I'll stop having Hezbollah send X number of rockets into Israel, but we want more advanced centrifuges in the nuclear side of this. So it wouldn't have helped get either to the place that we want it to be. So it was a very sad day, most of all, for our nation's security.
You also have significant experience working on U.S.-North Korea relations. In June, when President Trump met in Singapore with Kim Jong-un, the two of them issued this joint statement vowing to work toward complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. I have to tell you, to lay people, that sounds great. But what does that phrase, work toward complete denuclearization, actually require of the parties involved?
Well, so far it looks like not much of anything. It was the thinnest document that's ever come out of a negotiation with North Korea, either with the U.S. or with South Korea, with anybody for that matter. And we've seen that North Korea has a very different view of what denuclearization is. A, they don't talk about denuclearization of North Korea. They talk about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And for them, that means end of the war, replace an armistice with a peace treaty, which would then require, from their point of view, U.S. troops leaving the Korean Peninsula, that we could never have any nuclear weapons, even on ships if needed, in Korean waters, that it really is all about us, when in fact for us, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means them getting rid of their nuclear weapons and the long-range ballistic missiles that can deliver them. So we are very far apart. I tremendously appreciate what the South Korean government is trying to do to try to bridge this enormous gap. I appreciate that Secretary Pompeo has named Steve Biegun as a special envoy. He's a very capable professional. But it is not clear to me what the policy is for the Trump administration and how they expect to go about getting to where they want. And it's just disheartening when the president thanks Kim Jong-un for his unwavering support, and nothing much has changed.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Our longtime allies seem to have chosen not to react strongly to the president's expressions of disrespect for their leaders and their policies. What can you tell us, Ambassador, about the kinds of conversations U.S. diplomats might be having with their counterparts in those countries behind closed doors, their, you know, longtime U.S. allies, that would soften the blow of the president's rhetoric?
Well, I'm sure everyone's trying to explain away all of this difficult rhetoric. And actions, for that matter. It's not just the rhetoric. It's the tariffs war that is going on with many of our allies and partners, whether that's Canada around NAFTA or the European Union around steel and aluminum, or Japan, for that matter. So there's a lot happening in many countries. I know whenever I travel, people are trying to understand who they're supposed to listen to. President Trump says, I will meet with Iran's president anywhere, anytime, without condition. And immediately thereafter, Secretary Pompeo lays out a number of conditions for any such meeting. We've had all of these books and now the Bob Woodward book that's about to come out, as well as the anonymous New York Times op-ed that basically says, listen to us, don't listen to the president, because he gets undermined by his own team, who believes they're securing America's future, which is a very disturbing circumstance, quite frankly, on both ends of that spectrum. And so foreign leaders are working hard to decipher who they're supposed to talk to, what our policy is. And meanwhile, I think the most concerning thing is the United States, under President Trump, is isolating America. And our allies and partners are looking elsewhere for new allies and new partners. And at the end of the day, I don't think that's good for us.
So do you think those chilled relations with our longtime allies will outlast the Trump administration, whether that's for two more years or six?
I think if it's for two more years, we can get past it. The world is changing. It's not the same as it was. It is a multipolar world, though we do remain the world superpower, but it's a multipolar world. So the world will never be as it once was. But American leadership, which has been so critical to everything that's happened since the end of World War II and remains critical for things to really happen and move forward and get better, I think can be reestablished. If the president gets reelected for a second term and continues to govern in the way he has, then I think it is much more difficult.
Ambassador Wendy Sherman is a senior counselor at Allwright Stonebridge Group and senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. Previously, she served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Obama administration, special advisor and policy coordinator on North Korea in the Clinton administration. Her book is Not for the Faint of Heart: Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. Ambassador Sherman, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you to your listeners.
We hope that you will follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at K-E-R-A Think. You can find me at Chris Boyd Think. And subscribe to the Think podcast using any podcast app you like. You can learn more about upcoming shows at our website. That is think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.